Okay, so we're back for part two of eLearning 2.0 here at the Canadian Heritage Information Network. Isn't that nice the way I introduced this part two of the recording? And now if only I had done that for part one. So
patch it onto the front.
And just patch it onto the front. Okay, so here we are for part one. No, I'm just kidding. I'm a little less than professional with my recordings, but I think that's okay. Gives people a sense of what to expect when I come to give a talk. So there are no illusions. So I sometimes go give a talk and people are disappointed. I say, well, you heard that Teddy... Actually, it's never happened, but I rehearse it in my mind just in case it does. I've got, I don't know, about like 70 recordings of these things on my website now. And there's no excuse for anybody to say to me, well, I wasn't expecting such and such. But, well, I guess there is, because I have to spend like 2 weeks listening to them. Right, all of that was way off topic, but that's okay. Where was I? Right, big picture. There's the big picture again. Yeah, this is a continuation of the open content, open software, and it's more of a philosophical and even vaguely political point, but it is, I believe, the direction in which we are moving. And all other things being equal, the direction in which we ought to move is certainly not a direction that everyone endorses. But and it's some of the stuff that we even talked about earlier, the idea not just of government, but of government, schools, businesses, industry, public services. The whole concept of, and for that matter, people themselves, individuals, doing whatever it is that they do with society, the concepts of transparency. You look at how many people out there now that their life is an open book, and this is becoming more and more the case. And I think people are becoming easier and more comfortable with it. They're not so happy about having their identity stolen. They don't want to be that transparent, but they're more comfortable with that. Accountability, because people know what you're doing, you're held responsible for what you're doing, and then partnerships, more connections, more liaisons, and that's, like, we hear lots of talk about partnerships and things like that, and there's partnerships and there's partnerships. I just did a talk, in fact, almost exactly a week ago, where we talked about collaboration and that. And there's collaboration for the sake of collaborating. And, you know, and it's interesting because I see a lot of these funding programs, and they say, you will have, you know, a private sector partner. You will have three educational institutions or whatever. And so you get... Everyone knows how this works, right? Somebody has an idea, the concept that they want to push. So it's their project, and then what they do is they go scouting around for partners, and they get three or four people who say, yeah, okay, we'll pretend to be your partner, and there's your partnership. And so it goes forward. They're these enforced, externally driven partnerships are one thing. There is genuine partnership where, and the way I defined it last week was, it's an agreement entered into where there is a mutual exchange of value, where the benefit of the partnership is inherent in the partnership itself, as opposed to being motivated by some external criteria. Because they're talking about collaboration. I'm sitting there and I'm recording these sessions because I'm doing the summary, right? And by the end of the first day, I was sitting there thinking, well, the primary way to get collaboration going is, well, you pay people. And I'm thinking, what kind of collaboration is that? It's not really collaboration. It's like you're paying people, and then you look at the various drivers for community that are external to the benefits being derived from community, and you sort of see that tension there. Sadly, I lost that recording. It was an interesting discussion. Yeah, all that's way off topic. Well, it's not off topic. It's all one big web, isn't it? That's why it's so hard for me to write things. Try to write something. So I'm very unlikely to sit down and actually write a book beginning to end, because there is no beginning, there is no end, and you might as well start on page 492. You're at the same spot you would be if you were starting on page 1. What's happening now, and by now I mean at this very instant as we speak, is that the World Wide Web is changing. And I say that, and I go to crowds and I say that, and they sort of look at me, no, please no, because it took them 10 years to figure out the web as it is, and HTML and instant messaging and email and all of that. But the web is changing. And the slogan phrase that's being used to characterize this change is Web 2.0. And now there's a debate in the community. Should we call it Web 2.0? Maybe we should call it Web 3.0. Maybe we should call it Web 1.5. And all this stuff that they say is Web 2.0 isn't really Web 2.0. And it's all jargon anyways. But nonetheless, there is something happening out there. And what's happening is a shift in the nature of the web from being a medium like television, like radio, like newspapers, like magazines that you consume, to an environment or a platform or a place where you do things. And what this does is it changes the dynamic of your relationship with the material that's online. It changes the dynamic because before, and especially with the web, but also with various other things, it was pretty much a one-way flow of communication. And I've actually seen, you see some of these social network analysis, and they actually map the flow of information and the flow of communication. It's actually, they map a few things. One thing, the main thing they map, interestingly, is links. And then you can detect a flow in the links on the web. And you have the outgoing only sites. They'd be like typical blog sites where you go to the blog site and all the links are out. And then they sort of flow through this large conversational layer and then into this dead zone, which is commercial media. Because you go to a commercial media site, there are no outbound links, right? And if you're just sort of following links, you hit this dead end, which is the New York Times or whatever. That's changing a little bit. They are beginning now more to include outbound links. But when they first started, the whole idea was capture people. And then you have the flow of links, and it's very interesting, and it's much less talked about. The exact opposite flow is the flow of communication, the flow of information. It flows upstream from the links. The links are downstream, the information is upstream, which, you know, is why the newspapers didn't want outbound links, right? They want to be the source of this information that will then flow to their audience out there on the web. Web 2.0 is the collapsing of this. It is, to a large degree, the elimination of these dead zones. It's the placing of the users of the web in the same position as these traditional content producers and publishers. And I'll talk about it in a little bit, but the concept here is that it is as easy for your 13-year-old son to produce a New York Times as it is for the New York Times. Now, that's a wild overgeneralization and exaggeration, but nonetheless, the concept is the tools, the capacity, the power to do this is now in the hands of your 13-year-old son. And it's like we were talking before about, we talk about student-centered learning and the capacity and the responsibility for their learning is being put into the hands of the students. And the remark was that this technology gives them that capacity. They are taking this responsibility for their own thinking and their own learning as it is. We can't control it now. It is happening already. And so the question becomes not whether they should have control over their own learning. Then that gives it to them. Google gives it to them. Wikipedia gives it to them. The question is now, given that environment, how do we work within that environment and to the best advantage, both to our own interests and their interests? Web 2.0, characterized largely by user-generated content, and the first and the big wave that hit the internet was the blog. You're all familiar with blogging, I'm assuming. And what made blogging blogging? What made it the thing that it was? Is not the particular structure of a blog. There is a particular structure. It's a series of entries reverse dated. It's not the content of what goes into blogs, because we've seen anything can go into blogs, up to including cat pictures. And there's a blog out there. What is it? Yeah. Cats in Sinks. You know, somebody create a blog. Cats in Sinks. Go figure. But what made blogging blogging was the fact that anyone could do it. And more to the point, anyone could do it for free. 2001, blogging had already been around for 3 or 4 years. But what came onto the scene were sites like Blogger and LiveJournal, and the availability of software like Movable Type or Userland. And that put into the hands of people a very simple way to very quickly get high quality content, well, at least in presentation anyways, onto the internet. You know, they still wrote about cats and you know, whatever. You know, so, you know, in the grand scope of literature, it probably wasn't high-quality content, but the thing was they could do it. And out of this, indeed, did emerge quite a bit of high-quality content. Content now that rivals the commercial news and publication industry for importance and impact. What is the success criteria? People use it. How do you know people using it? Because it's toppling governments. I've picked up just a few characteristics of blogs. The other thing is a blog belongs to the blog writer. It is that person's blog. It is their individual expression. This is really important when we are working in a network. Remember, as I said before, there is no single bit of knowledge that is unchanging, is firm, is endlessly true. The knowledge itself is distributed, that our knowledge of that knowledge is different from your head to your head to your head. The way to express that when we're talking about a network is, it's almost like a hologram, right? Because you got all of these things here, and they're all in this web, and then everyone who looks at it from a different perspective sees a slightly different thing. And when that thing that we're looking at is being described, we need to include that point of view, that context, that perspective in our description of what we're looking, as opposed to trying to abstract that out. Because if we abstract that out, we lose the perspective and we no longer understand, we no longer have as clear an idea of what it is that we're looking at. And we see this, and it evolved naturally in the world of blogs, where it's not like that, you know, whoever created a blog said, look, if you're going to create a blog, it has to be personalized. It has to be opinionated. Nobody said you have to do it. But people, when they had this capacity to take control over the production of their own media, when they had this capacity, this is how they did it. They did it, I'm writing from my point of view. I'm writing about things that are important to me. And then the concept, the knowledge, if you will, the truth, emerges from the interconnection and the linkages between all of those blogs. It is your classic 10 people looking at the elephant story, except the 10 people are in constant dynamic communication, and if you want to understand the elephant that they're all looking at, you kind of take like a third-party perspective and look down at this network of interactions, and the knowledge of the elephant emerges from all of those individual points of view and is not contained in any of them, but is a result of them. And it's interesting because, to continue with that story, if those people reporting the elephant took away that personal perspective and tried to represent it as some sort of objective, eternal truth, what you get is not a picture that emerges, but 10 different accounts that can't possibly all be true, and interestingly, are all, in fact, false descriptions. You need the concept, you need the context, you need the perspective in order to get the elephant at all.
But they're also true.
Well,
they are false, but they're also true. From my point of view, or their point of view, each point of view is right.
From,
the analogy is life itself.
From their point of view, each point of view is true. Absolutely. No question about it. But if you remove the phrase point of view, and they just say that what there is this flat, grainy surface, and that's the sum total of it. It's no longer true. It can only be a partial representation from the specific point of view of what there is.
An interpretation. Which makes everything relative, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it makes everything relative, but keep in mind, there can still actually be an elephant there,
yes.
A one and only one elephant, right? It's not relativism in the sense that we've done away with the elephant entirely. There is no elephant, right? There can still be an elephant. There can still be something that is a fact of the matter. But it's how we get at that fact of the matter and how we assemble or construct our knowledge of that fact of the matter, that is the attitude that changes here. So it's relativism, but without the relativism. That's the sort of thing that they put on your tombstone. Relatively speaking, he's dead.
He was a good person.
In the field of e-learning, and you've probably seen it, I've linked to the EDUCAUSE where I did the article on educational blogging. There have been quite a number of articles on educational blogging. Will Richardson, if you're not familiar with him and you want to follow this up, focuses on blogging and learning to a large degree. The Institut Saint-Joseph in Quebec City, which is what I wrote about. This year, they've actually focused more on wikis than on blogs, but they're still important in blogging. Seb Paquette, who worked with us at the National Research Council, now he's working with Social Text, did some blogging projects with some schools in New Brunswick. There's a host of blogging and learning projects that are taking place out there now, and a lot of knowledge is being gained from that. And of course, we're getting the inevitable bit of pushback now, and the pushback is, well, blogging isn't for everyone, it isn't for everything. And I'm sort of looking at that, well, we knew that. You know, I mean, nobody said blogging would replace math. That wasn't the point. But it becomes this mechanism that is used in schools to allow their students to actually do some of this creating, some of this production of content for themselves, and more importantly, to be read. to create, not it's not just about creating the content, it's about creating the content and thereby becoming part of this larger network. As at the Institut Saint-Joseph, the best story that they had for me there was there was a circus that came through town, and some of the students went to the circus, and they went back home to their school, and they blogged about going to the circus. And a few days go by, and then there's a comment on the blog. Someone from the circus had read the blog about the circus, and from wherever they were now, had written a comment back to this grade 5 student, thanking them for their review of the circus and responding to some of the comments. You talk about empowering, right? This 5-year-old is engaged in a dialogue with a performer in the circus that he just saw. Outstanding. And that's where the effectiveness of blogs comes in learning.
Do you foresee a need for having people say, okay, certain comments put in those blogs are appropriate or some of them are not appropriate?
Well, I mean, if it was strictly up to me, oh, you mean comments by external people?
Yeah, or internal,
sure. Well, I mean...
Students getting, censorship.
Yeah.
Or should there be discrimination within those...
Okay, we got two separate questions here. Okay, first question is, the last thing I did before I came here to give this talk is I went into my own database and removed some spam from my comments area. Diet pills, weight pills, play Texas Hold'em, get rid of that. So there is certainly room for editing the comments that come in from the great wide world, because the great wide world will abuse your space. This is not an opinion. They will abuse your space and abuse it to the tune of like thousands of times a day. It's a huge problem. So the harder question is, do you censor what 5-year-olds put on the internet? And the quick answer is, in a sense, you have to, because 5-year-olds will put things that they really shouldn't put on the internet. And I don't mean things like stories about their mother and father, but I mean things like their home address and phone number. With 5-year-olds, there is a social responsibility to keep them safe. And part of keeping them safe means that there's a certain limit to what they can put of themselves out there in the great wide world, because the great wide world will abuse them just the way it abuses comment areas. So there is that. But that said, I wouldn't go much further than that. I mean, the presumption, the default position here, in my opinion, is that this needs to be a space for free expression. And the free expressions of a 5-year-old, we understand, are not always going to be the best, well-thought-out expressions. But I also think that when a 5-year-old says something really stupid on their blog and get repercussions, that's a good thing. Because they understand very quickly that there are consequences to what they do. So as long as we're protecting them from being harmed, I mean, if society is afraid of the utterances of a 5-year-old, then our society is not on very stable ground. Right? We should be able to handle it. Right? And so really the only criterion that I would want to employ is, you know, does it put the child in danger? That would be my view here. You know, and then the rest of it is social consequences. What are the reactions? And again, we make sure that these consequences do not endanger or harm the child. That would be my view. I'm not sure how widely held it would be. Okay. I know, I'm just trying to defend it.
No, I actually appreciate the fact that you're giving me a very honest point of view. I expected that answer from you.
Sure.
And but it can be used at a greater length as well.
Oh, absolutely.
And, but yeah. I totally agree. I have not seen it as a social repercussion. For example, a student from high school responding to someone else in a very rude manner.
Right.
Well, there will be a social repercussion from it. And
right.
Maybe it'll be for the better of the other readers to say, to be able to read, well, wait a second, you know, if I wrote this kind of stuff, this is what I get as far as a remark. It might not just be students reading this, it might be other people.
Exactly.
Very good. Thank you very much.
The picture of e-learning in general, and this is the e-learning 2.0 bit, that emerges from the discussion that we've had thus far. I'm sorry, you ever have these intuitions that you better check? All right. I've learned, go with the intuition. It was all working fine, it's recording, no problem, but you have this feeling, go with it. Never ignore those. Okay. This is the picture that emerges. This diagram here was actually created by Scott Wilson, who works with CETUS in Britain. It's also been worked over a bit by Dave Tosh, who's behind an application called ELGG. I don't know what it stands for. I always think of it as just like egg. And so the meaning of the acronym is just not in my ears. E-learning something, e-learning group generator? I don't know. Dave will probably listen to this and write me, it's, and then say things like, you numbskull, after. There are sometimes repercussions. Anyhow, And what I want to do with this diagram, because this really is the core of the concept, is to contrast it with the model of educational technology that is currently and typically employed in academic environments, and for that matter, in corporate environments. The technology of choice these days is the learning management system, or some variant thereof. In schools proper, it's the learning management system, but when we expand our circles a bit, it generalizes a bit more to like content management system, and in particular instances, like a portal is this sort of thing, right? A content repository, to agree, is this sort of thing. But the idea behind all of these types of application is that they are, to a large degree, institution-centered. For example, the University of Alberta uses WebCT. WebCT is a learning management system. When you access that, it's the University of Alberta's WebCT. And when you log on to it, you log on with your University of Alberta log-on identity. And the content in WebCT is put there by, often authored by, and put there by staff employed by WebCT. By the University of Alberta. The look and feel, the presentation of the material, the organization of the material is determined by staff at the University of Alberta. And then the same is true for institutional portals. You see lots of institutional portals out there that are providing access to information. The New York Public Library website, for example, which is as good an example of that sort of website as you'll see. But you go there, it's the NYPL website, right? And it's NYPL Holdings, and the structure and the organization are determined by NYPL. And then the little stories that they do are the explorations. I forget the one I saw, shower curtains or something like that, is done by an NYPL curator. And so it's institution-centered. very common, very typical, and to a large degree not surprising, because that's where all the expertise and importantly all the funding lay, was in these institutions. So, you know, I'm not saying it was necessarily a wrong thing to do at the time. What I am saying, though, is that is shifting. And where it's shifting is in the direction of this diagram. You see in the center there, that round circle where it says future VLE. What that is the individual person's, the individual student's personal space. It's like the learning management system of Steve, if you will. And it does not belong to the University of Alberta, the New York Public Library, or anything like that. It belongs to Steve. He's a lot like my blogging site, right? It's, you know, I might use Blogger, I might use LiveJournal, but it's mine. It's not Blogger's, it's not LiveJournal's, it belongs to me. I determine what it's going to look like, I determine what it's going to contain. This future VLE is that environment. And surrounding that environment, you can see all of those things. I don't want to get up out of the chair because then my voice will fade on the microphone. So I don't, and I want to be nice to the people who are online. So I'm just going to wave madly. Those of you who are listening, imagine me waving madly. You can see on the outside are the various online services, online content providers, online applications that feed into, if you will, although the arrows really are for the most part bi-directional, into this VLE. And up in the upper left corner, that's LiveJournal. So the person's VLE interacts with LiveJournal. And that person there actually has a blog on LiveJournal that they access and manage from their personal environment. 43 things in the other corner is like a to-do list. It's a list of things that you want to do. So, again, they manage and interact with this site that does to-do lists for them. Flickr, they're sort of in the lower right. That's a place where you can upload and store your images and describe your images and link to your images. And, again, you access that, you work with that through your VLE. But also, the institutional sites, like the university website, he's got Bolton Institute. Here it would be, it could be Bolton. There's no reason why it wouldn't be, but in my case it might be, you know, University of Alberta or University of Calgary or Algonquin College or any of the places that I went to. Even this many years later, right? You know, I haven't been to any of these institutions for a long time, but you know, I would still have, say, my connection to Algonquin College there, and I don't know what it would be used for, but I could still have it. It would still be part of my personal learning space. At the very least, I could access my transcripts from 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And in a similar way, the student's VLE would interact in some way with sites like New York Public Library, with sites like Google Groups or Yahoo Groups, with Skype. Skype now has an open interface. So inside my personal learning space, I have access to my online synchronous voice communication tool, which in this case happens to be Skype. The idea here is that a person online no longer works with one website and then goes to another website and then goes to another website, but rather the environment they're working with is created by a collection of websites or collection of services that are all connected in this instance to my own personal environment. And the rest of Web 2.0/eLearning 2.0 is the mechanism behind that, the actual technology of how we make it work. You see all the little bits of writing in that. Those are all the APIs and the protocols and things like that. I'll talk about those in a bit that actually power this whole system.
But
answer it, but I would like to my question, but I would like to point out. You used alternatively personal learning and personal environment.
Right.
And I think it is on purpose, because there, we are talking about personal environment, because we cannot have a personal learning and a personal museum and a personal set and so on. So this is an architectural problem, and if we go on the institutional metaphor and having institutions on the web, we'll just create endless personal space competing with each other. So the idea is how to work together to enable a personal environment for people who are focusing on learning to be able to focus or to enhance their curiosity to go to places they don't know of or to explore things they new to them and so on. So that's how to create this personal environment with the possibility to be creative and to work together.
Sure.
So how to open this personal to collaborative sharing and
I'm very deliberately fuzzify, as you pointed out, the distinction between personal learning and personal environment. I think that's
what initially I wanted to provoke you on that, but then I saw the fuzziness and I said, okay.
Yes.
It's fuzzy, so he just wants
if it's fuzzy, it must be deliberately
person.
So.
No, he wants
excuse
to
me.
About the personal life, but no.
Yeah. One of the things that I say in some of the talks that I give, that one of the effects of this, of all of this, is a breaking down of the traditional barriers between different aspects of our lives. And it's I have a longer millennial generation slideshow somewhere else, but you have the pre-network view of things. You have your work life, you have your home life, you have your learning life, and never the twain shall meet, right? Pardon?
And various disciplines.
And even various disciplines, absolutely. You know, you have chemistry and physics, and oh, don't let them mix. You put the chemists and physicists together, and all you get is anarchy. But this is changing, and the distinction between these different parts of your life are breaking down. And this is especially the case with learning. And I talk a lot with Jay Cross, and Jay Cross talks about workflow learning. And what he's on about when he talks about workflow learning is taking the learning, and instead of treating learning is something that you stop work and then you go learn for a while, taking the learning and it actually becomes part of the process of doing work. There's a slide later on where I talk about this in the wider context, and I say something like taking the learning, which we currently think of as being separate from everything else, and it becomes part of just going through your everyday course of events. And there are a whole bunch of practical instances of that. I have a series of about four slides later on in this presentation where I deal with that. And so when I'm talking about the technological infrastructure, which is what I'm mostly after with this slide, I'm not thinking a learning application, a work application, a drawing application. I'm thinking of a personal environment in which you work, in which you learn, in which you communicate with your friends, with which you collaborate, which you use to work with your images and your pictures, which you use to handle your audio. And so I'm looking at that sort of environment. And even as I think about this right now, and I haven't had this thought exactly this way before. That's why I do these, right? But we have this circle, and it's got a hard-edged boundary around it, a future VLE, and we have this picture in our mind, don't we? Like, yeah, well, it's kind of like Outlook or Microsoft Word, where it's some kind of concrete application. But I think it's not even that. It's not even so concrete that you actually download your future VLE and run it. It's almost you need to think about it in the sense of a virtual application, where it's not really an application. It's the collection of applications all working together and interacting, and then the thing that is you is your identity, your data, your concepts. These things being communicated back and forth between these things so that there's an emergent personal space across all of these different applications. And the simple way of expressing that, one simple way of getting at that is when people talk about single sign-on and personal ID and things like that. And imagine if, when you are on the web, all of the websites thought you were the same person. So that if you're at Yahoo, Yahoo says, "Oh, hello, Stephen Downs." And if you go to Google, Google says, "Hello, Stephen Downs." And the person that those two sites mean is one and the same person. And so that my data on Yahoo, my data on Google, it not only belongs to me, but that's accessible from inside each of the other applications. That's the picture. And so in a sense, this picture is a bit misleading. It sort of makes you think, oh yeah, it's kind of like, the Web 2.0 version of Microsoft Word. But it's more than that. And there probably will be, some kind of core application to get things off the ground. Right? Some place where you say to a computer somewhere, "My name is Stephen Downs," hit enter. Right? But the bulk of this, the power of this comes from the communication and the common information layer between all of these applications, rather than in it being some new tool. And so what's happening here is that there isn't a center to your online presence. So right now, universities very much want to make themselves the center of the student's online life. You'll go to, the university page will be your home page, and it'll be like my university of whatever and all of that. But there isn't a center anymore. It's just you have a persistent presence on the web as expressed by continuous and cross-platform, cross-application persistence of certain types of data and communication between that data in different places.
So, and I realize I'm simplifying here, but are you essentially saying that the browser or your picture base becomes your identity or your identity?
The way I've designed it on my system, yes. But that's just one way of doing it. But yeah, I've described an identity system that would fulfill this function, and that resides in the browser. And there's a product out there, it's still like pre-alpha or whatever, called Flock, F-L-O-C-K. There was a Puffy Wired article about it a little while ago. I've been looking at it, and this is sort of like the next generation browser, where a lot of this social presence is embodied right in the Flock browser. Basically, what Flock does is it takes a browser and embeds social networking into the browser. It's a very interesting product.
And Microsoft is trying the next operating system to solve or to install the
Yeah, the big problem with Microsoft would like to be this for you. There's no question about it.
That's what they said. I don't know. Oops, yeah. We lost 20. As soon as we talk about Microsoft.
Yes.
I'll call her back.
Sure. And when she comes online, well, I'll just say, and that finishes. No, I'm just kidding. I can't do that to her.
La communication n'a pu être établie.
Maybe she'll call back. Maybe something has happened.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Well, that's no problem. Because, you know, if one of you suddenly lost the capacity to hear or see what was going on, we would stop and see what this is.
Would you also use maybe the flow analogy with what you just said, that we're not core-centered? We're still centered because we all think that the world revolves around us. I mean, that's just human nature. But it's like a flow. All the sides are wherever it becomes an extension of yourself and vice versa.
Sure. I'm not sure if I could do it better than you just did it. Especially, and this is, it's an important point that people do forget, particularly when they start talking about communication and collaboration online, because there's this supposition, right, that it's not centered, but of course it is centered, right? I'm at the center of my own web, right? And that's an important thing, and it comes up a lot in the social networking literature, that it's not the subsuming of the personal self into this network, but rather it's the placement of the self as an autonomous individual, as Mill would say, doing their own good in their own way in this communications environment. So autonomy, personal centeredness, these are important features of this. And indeed, you don't get what they sometimes call the network effect without personal autonomy, without diversity. I have another talk where I talk about, he's asked about the success factors, and there are success factors that are more than just juice. And I talk about the success factors of networks, and these success factors are diversity. If you have diverse entities rather than a monoculture type entities, openness is a success factor. You can tell whether it's a successful network by how open the network is. And then the empowerment and communication aspect. Can you freely send messages back and forth? Do you send messages back and forth? Which is kind of what the use gets at. The flow thing, how do I want to phrase that? Because, I mean, when I talk about flow in networks, usually what I do is I refer people to Douglas Rushkoff, and then I wave my hands a little bit and I'm done. But the idea here is, again, we think of knowledge as static. We think of knowledge artifacts especially as static. Books, tapes, magazines, record albums, or CDs these days and that. But in the network environment, that ceases to be the case. Oh, you still have like physical entities, you still have digital entities that kind of look like physical entities, but our frame, our way of looking at these changes. In the pre-network way of looking at things, these were things that you gathered and you would assemble. You put together a library of resources, for example. And knowledge and learning was a matter of accumulation. And providers would think of, you know, we're selling you discrete things. We're selling you a bit of learning the way we would sell you a book, the way we would sell you a coffee, the way we would sell you an apple. You sort of have that physical object picture of what these knowledge items are. But in the network view, when you're acting as I say, a diverse, autonomous individual in a network, and the knowledge and information becomes states in the network, the mental picture that you want to have of this is not as a set of resources, but as the capacity to tap into a flow. And the analogy that I use to express this is learning on this picture becomes like plugging into the wall and getting electricity, or turning on the tap and getting water. And in the normal state of affairs, nobody thinks of accumulating that. Like, when you go home in the evening, you're not going to think, oh, power's on. I'm going to collect as much as I can and put it in the cupboard so I'll have it. Nobody does that. Nobody thinks of it that way. Same with water, except in certain extreme situations where you come to believe that this flow will be cut off. You might hoard your water. You still can't really hoard your electricity, which is a problem overall. So the idea is that knowledge and learning is, instead of something that you have, it is something that you tap into. It's something that you connect to. And if you view knowledge and learning this way, then the concept of what it is to provide knowledge and learning changes. And a whole range of opportunities opens up to you. I have two paradigm examples that I use all the time. Well, a host of them are possible. People who've listened to me on these audios before are probably sick of it. But the one example is the fishing rod that teaches you to fish. And the idea here is you go to the store, you buy a fishing rod because you want to go fish, and you go down to the river and you put your thing on your fishing rod, and then you cast your fishing rod, and it's sort of a little plunk. And your fishing rod remarks to you, "You've never fished before, have you?" And you sort of look at your fishing rod, and this brand new fishing rod, you weren't expecting that voice, and you say, "Well, no." And your fishing rod says, "Well, I can help you." And your fishing rod is in communication with your PDA, telephone, whatever device you happen to have. So your PDA, telephone, or whatever, whoops, it's not on that slide, that's your VLE, or at least your current physical manifestation of your VLE. And your fishing rod now coordinates with your personal coordinates, so it learns what it can about you, or at least what you're willing to tell it, and it begins to teach you how to fish. And it might speak to you, it might say, "Well, look, the last time you cast, you made a jerky motion with your arm," because fishing rod has gyroscopes and things like that. It's motion sensitive, so that it actually knows what you're doing. So the fishing rod tells you, "Make a longer stroke with your arm and let go at a 45 degree angle. Try it now." And you say, "Okay." And the voice may be coming out of the fishing rod, or it may be coming out of your PDA or whatever. 2025 is probably a direct neural transmission, so you're not bothering the people next to you, right? And so you pull the thing back, and the fishing rod goes, "That's better, but you released at a 47.5 angle instead of 45. So you want to hold on to it just a little bit longer." And the fishing rod will step you through how to fish, reacting. And so the point here is, the act of fishing is itself the act of learning to fish. And this is what I mean when I talk about collapsing the difference between learning and doing things, right? It's conceptually no longer makes sense to think of, "Well, I'm going to stop fishing now and go to a classroom and learn to fish." And, you know, somebody with this technology in their hand would think that concept is absurd and ridiculous. Second example is a little more mundane, but it's the same kind of thing. And it's an example that I thought of when I was on the other side of the Confederation Bridge in Prince Edward Island. And I'm in these, they have little boutique stores there, sort of like a Potemkin village there. It didn't exist before the bridge did, but now it does, a bunch of little stores there. And there's strawberry jam that you can buy there. And I went to a conference in Charlottetown after seeing this little village, and the person it's all a knowledge and information conference. He was talking about, he advised the manufacturers of this jam about how to make this jam better, and marketing the store and all that. And I thought to myself, well, if they really wanted to make the jam better, they would embed learning in the jam, or the jar more accurately, so that once I got the jam home, I knew what to do with it. Yeah, because, okay, yeah, you put jam on bread, but think of all the other things you can do with jam, and all the things you can learn about jam. A jar of strawberry jam could actually give you all kinds of knowledge and information of what went into the jam, where it came from, the history of these particular berries, who picked them, what day it was, what the weather was, what you can do with the jam, recipes. Connect you to the strawberry jam recipe pie baking community, where you can trade your experiences with this jam. You see what I mean, right? And so the jam and the learning are one and the same sort of thing. This, you know, and this is the sort of thing, and I know that people in the heritage, culture, museum community have already tied into this in a big way, with the self-guiding tours and things like that. I was at Peel Castle exactly 6 days ago, which is on the west side of the Isle of Man. Why? Because I could. And I walk in there and they give you one of these, it's really inconvenient. It's this great big stick with a, and it's like a telephone thing. They probably have names, don't they? Pardon? That's there you go. I knew there was a precise name for it. Just so you know, it was really annoying. Because it's big and heavy. And so now I'm carrying my camera, my coffee, and this big and heavy thing, which is long and skinny, so it always fell out of my pocket. And then to listen to it, I actually had to stop what I was doing, hold it to my ear, and I couldn't do things while I was listening to it. But other than that, it was pretty good. And
there's a new generation of those coming up.
Oh, okay. Well, that's
good.
There
will be the little, like the, iPod. Yeah, exactly. Like the iPod in 1 year.
Sure.
There'll be little
stickers
on the wall, and this will be activated. And
those 1 year things, don't use them. Why? Because people with glasses, at least me, they always fall off. Because they're intended to hook on your ear, but I already got something hooked on my ear. And they give you those on the airplanes too, right? And I'm forever, maybe if I wedge it under my glasses, the weight of my glasses will hold it in.
Actually, the iPod, it's interesting because I think it's the Museum of Modern Art in New York have downloads that you can download to your iPod that are not just tours by the museum curator, but they have some people who have visited, they have somebody from the New York School of Fine Arts, so they're a little bit edgier than the traditional New York museum curator, so it's interesting there.
Yeah. So you see what's happening here, right? Now, the way this thing in the castle at Peel worked, right, and you're very familiar with this, there's a little post with a number on it, right, and so you get to the post, I say, stand facing the post, so me being me, I'd stand 90 degrees to the post, because I'm not going to do what they tell me, but, and sometimes I just type a number at random and then try to figure out, okay, what are they talking about, but I love the freedom, right? But anyhow, the way it works, right, you look at the number, you type in the number, and you get your little message. The key to the system, of course, is the number. And the number is what makes everything work. Now, but this number can be, well, first of all, anything and anywhere. And I think it's a later slide. You have RFIDs, remote frequency identification, which basically is a little chip that sends a wireless signal with some basic information. Well, you have that thing. That thing sends a little signal to your personal computer environment, personal communications environment, and now you tap into it. And yes, you don't just have to have the voice of the curator and the sound effects, because it's Peel Castle, and every frame is like, you know, because it's, you know, yeah, I know it's a windswept island, but you're going to get, because you cannot avoid it, because people will do this whether you want them to or not just the museum version of things, but visitors, commentators, experts. You'd be able to access photographs that were taken at this location, and you, of course, while you're standing there, can add your own commentary, audio or typed. You take your digital picture and you upload it. You're standing there in front of that I forget what those round things are called, but keeps, whatever. But you're standing in front of that tower. You take a picture of it. You upload it. The RFID tags it to that location so that the instant you upload it, it now becomes associated. You can actually stand there and look at this tower and see your photograph as it's being displayed to subsequent visitors to that very tower. And you get this explosion of information, of content, and mostly user-generated content about a particular entity, about a particular artifact, whether it's a castle, whether it's a jar of strawberry jam, whether it's a fishing rod, whether it's trigonometry. And that's what this slide's about, user-generated multimedia. Oh, I'm sorry.
I think we will have to break for lunch at 12, if you don't mind. And Monsieur Namir and Annie may come back at 1:30 when we come back from lunch.
Okay.
So if that's okay with you.
And I'll just give you guys all a preview. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that.
I hope you come back.
Yeah, I'm not going anywhere, well, at least for a few hours.
No, I mean back, you will walk us back through the presentation.
Oh, yeah. where was this? No, previous, there we are. Yeah, basically the rest of this talk, I slide into some of the technology that we use to make this work, RSS, content syndication, and all of that. And then the end of the presentation actually branches out to some of the things we've already been talking about the different types of learning. So
maybe the presentation is finished. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, it's up to you guys again.
I don't know.
We'll take our break for lunch, and if you feel like coming back after, that's cool. And if you feel like it's finished, that's cool,
okay,
too, because it's your perspective that determines whether this is finished or not.
Relevant with your RFID, Danielle.
I have a couple of
RFID is not in sync with it.
Who is responsible for the personal space, how the personal space is communicating with...
Yeah. All of that, in my presentation, falls under the heading of the self-organizing network, and that goes at the top, and then all of the mechanics of that follow, the network structures, network semantics, network syntax, including RSS and all of that, and then the theory of why if you set it up like that, then when you're standing in front of the castle at Peel, you will get the content that you want, and not, say, an advertisement for diet pills.
Yes,
that's
because
yeah.
We need to architect.
That's the hard, tricky part. Yeah. And maybe I'll have to come back again sometime, too. I have family and all. I'm always happy to come back. Yeah, so let's take our lunch break, and I'll close off this part of the audio, and maybe we'll be back. Maybe we won't.
I'm sure we will.